The Nat Turner Slave Rebellion occurred in Southampton County, Virginia, in August 1831. It was led by a 31-year-old man who was inspired by a series of heavenly visions to lead his people in a great battle to destroy slavery. It was a watershed event in American history, and Turner became one of the best-known figures in our history, but he remains one of the least understood. Our guest this week, Kenneth Greenberg, has tried to shed some light on this elusive figure in a new book, Nat Turner, A Slave Rebellion in History and Memory, and a new documentary on Nat Turner, subtitled A Troublesome Property, for which Greenberg served as co-producer, co-writer, and historian. Welcome, Ken.
Nice to meet you.
Good. Let's begin by just repeating the story of Nat Turner, just the facts, as they say.
Actually, the odd thing about Nat Turner, this is true for any historical story, is they really aren't just the facts, because as you pick a fact, you shape an interpretation.
Right.
But let me give you what I think are the often repeated facts connected with the story. Nat Turner lived in a remote part of Virginia, in the southern part of Virginia, in the county, Southampton County. Town of Jerusalem is where he lived nearby, and he was a Bible reader, very unusual for a slave who knew how to read, but he apparently had a great knowledge of the Bible, lived near the town of Jerusalem, and I think was inspired by that connection. As he grew up, he had a sense of his own special purpose somehow. People in the community, his family, all seemed to think he was destined for some kind of greatness. And then as the years in the 1820s and into the early 1830s, he began to have a series of visions which he felt were signs from Christ that he was supposed to pick up the mantle that Christ had once had and that he was supposed to lead a great rebellion against slavery. And so in August of 1831, he met first with a few other conspirators at a place called Cabin Pond, and then this group moved rapidly from house to house, beginning at Turner's home farm, the Joseph Travis residence, where they killed every person who they encountered, with some exceptions. They did skip some houses, but basically men, women, and children were killed, and they moved rapidly, and as they moved, they gained recruits. The rebellion probably killed in the end somewhere between close to 60 white people. The number of active rebels may have been between 60 and 80. But within a very short period of time, the entire state of Virginia and even beyond became mobilized. 3,000 militia members began to descend on the county, and they moved in. And the rebellion was basically put down very harshly within about a 24-hour period, not only with the killing of many people involved in the rebellion, many African Americans in the rebellion, but random killings of others who were suspected or just a kind of a killing frenzy that occurred among the white population. We'll never quite know the numbers of blacks who were killed in the rebellion, but it far exceeded the number of whites. This is typical of slave rebellions in general. But Nat Turner himself eluded capture for 70 days after the rebellion was put down. This is an extraordinary feat. You have the most wanted man in America at that time, eluding capture, never wandering very far from his home residence. Ultimately, he was captured at the end of October and was tried very quickly. But just before his trial, a local white lawyer, not his lawyer, but a local white lawyer named Thomas R. Gray, met with him and took down what Gray says is Nat Turner's confession, and then very quickly published it. Nat Turner was hanged on November 11th, and this confession, published version, was in circulation within 2 weeks after that, basically. It's one of the great documents because it's one of the few times we have an example of getting into the mind of an American slave. Nat Turner was hanged, and then one of the most immediate reactions to this was an actual debate in the Virginia legislature. Probably one of the most open, free, certainly one of the last debates that happened in the South, in which they actually discussed abolishing slavery. They discussed it because they were fearful that Nat Turner's lurked everywhere in the state of Virginia, and then they couldn't identify such a person ahead of time, and therefore it was an unsafe place. They wanted to make it safe again by both getting rid of slavery and getting rid of African Americans. They wanted to ship them out of the state, out of the country as much as possible. After the rebellion ended, after Nat Turner was hanged, after the debate occurred, and of course they didn't abolish slavery in Virginia, Nat Turner became a great symbol, symbol for blacks as a cornerstone of resistance and whites who hated slavery, and a symbol of white hatred of everything that they feared about blacks in the South.
Does that relate to why you added to your title A Slave Rebellion in History and Memory?
Absolutely. You know, the event certainly occurred in Southampton County, and then there was this legacy of Nat Turner in which the story constantly gets retold, told by many people, by historians, by poets, playwrights, novelists. There's a folk memory of it. So there are many retellings of the story, and Nat Turner, in a sense, remains vividly alive in our culture throughout its history since those events by being part of American memory in a deep way.
Now, we can't take the time to go through all of the 13 essays as good as they are, but let's break it down by the four parts in which you divide the book and just briefly tell us what you consider to be the main points made in each one. Let's start with part one, The Search for Nat Turner.
Sure. That consists of two essays. My essay, which I think sets the tone for the whole book and asks some questions that were never asked before about Nat Turner, it asks three simple questions. What was Nat Turner's name? Nobody else has ever thought of this as a significant issue. What did he look like and what happened to his body? Let me just give you a flavor for the problem of dealing with Nat Turner by discussing briefly the problem of his name. Everybody calls him Nat Turner, but it's not so clear of who named him and how he got that name. What happened was, during the course of the life of a slave in the South, there are no last names legally attached to a person who was enslaved. He was probably called Nat by whites. We don't know what the black community called him during the course of his childhood, for example. We don't know what his mother called him. We don't know what he called himself. There's no record of that. We know that Turner was the name of his first master, but by the time of the rebellion, he had a different master, Joseph Travis, so the fact that he ended up Nat Turner is quite interesting. Who made that decision is completely unclear. If you look at the trial records and you look at the voices of other blacks during the trial, you discover that he's never called Nat Turner by any African American. He's called Captain Nat. He's called General Nat. The place where he's really called Nat Turner is in some white newspaper accounts, and then in this Confessions of Nat Turner, which is, of course, written down by Gray, that's the place where Nat Turner's name sticks with him. African Americans in the North who came to admire him immediately said, Nat Turner isn't his name. Nat is a diminutive, the kind of thing associated with a slave. And people like Frederick Douglass, for example, always called Nat Turner Nathaniel Turner, saying that was the real name that he deserved, which was the full honorific attached with him. So you ask the question, what was his name? He had many different names, and no one knows what he called himself, actually. What he looked like, if you look at historical accounts, good historians, they consistently get this issue wrong. Because they're not looking at the one source they need to look at. There is one governor's description, a kind of a wanted poster, during the period when they're searching for Nat Turner. And in that wanted poster, basically, in words, it says, Nat Turner was light-skinned, but not a mulatto. There is no one, no historian, no novelist, no poet, until basically I stumbled across this, who actually described him as light-skinned in anything. What you'll discover is both whites and blacks refer to him repeatedly in historical memory as dark-skinned. And they had their own various reasons for doing this. Blacks wanted to have a great black hero who was black. Whites wanted to have him represent the black race and everything which was degraded, and they wanted him black as well. So again, what he looks like is quite lost in historical memory. And then after he's executed, he's clearly dissected, and there is no grave you can go to in Southampton County to visit Nat Turner. There's no marker. There's no monument. His body is scattered. And in fact, his body pieces keep turning up throughout American history. His head, for example, people have cited his head in various locations throughout history.
Okay. Well, I want to have a few moments to deal with your documentary. So very briefly, can you pick up on a couple of points that you think are important from the rest of the book?
Sure. There's one section where I present two different stories of Nat Turner. Herbert Apthecker is one of the most interesting, probably one of the greatest historians of the 20th century because of the work he did on Nat Turner, which started his career. He wrote a master's essay at Columbia University on Turner in 1937, and he wrote about Turner as a great hero at a time when basically white racists were depicting slavery as a benevolent institution and Nat Turner as a fanatic and crazy man. And he actually went back to the sources and presented lots of the evidence which historians still use today. In the same section, Thomas Paramore is another historian who's recently deceased, as is Aptheker, by the way, and he describes Nat Turner as a mystic, as not a revolutionary leader, as unable to lead a military effort of any sort, as not preventing his men from drinking, as wandering aimlessly through the countryside killing white people, a radically different image of Nat Turner.
Right. Okay, well, let's turn to your documentary because you only have a couple minutes left. And let me ask you a couple questions on that. First of all, why did you subtitle it A Troublesome Property?
Given everything I've said, what we're really talking about in reference to A Troublesome Property is that obviously Nat Turner was regarded as property by the white people who owned him. But then after he dies, and even before he dies, he becomes the property of those who try to capture his image. He becomes the property of the newspapers who write about him. He becomes the property of Thomas Gray, who tries to create a particular image of Nat Turner. And he becomes the property of every historian, poet, playwright, novelist after him as well. And what the movie tries to do is to tell the story of how no single image of Nat Turner emerges in our culture. Just as his body is cut up into pieces, his image remains cut up into pieces as a kind of reflection of racial division in our society.
And you do that by dramatizing scenes differently, different versions of a story, and interspersing documentary footage and interviews. It's an interesting approach.
It's actually almost unique. And in a way, one way to think about the film is to think of it as an anti-Ken Burns approach to history. Rather than presenting a single story, we present multiple stories, showing, first of all, the real complexity that historians deal with and that American memory deals with. And by having historians and others comment on the recreated versions, we constantly undercut what viewers see before them. So in the end, someone looking at the film will not have a particularly clear image of the real Nat Turner. They will have a set of images which tells you a lot about our society and about race relations in our society as people look at Nat Turner in radically different ways.
Could you have approached this from the perspective of Ken Burns? Could it have been told in a more linear fashion, or in this particular case with Turner, was it just out of the question?
No, actually, I've been working on this. The amount of historical research necessary to reconstruct a real Nat Turner is beyond belief. No one has ever come close to it. After all, think of that one question I asked, which is the question of what his name was. Now, I spent 20 pages this pointing out how problematic his name was, and in the end, we didn't know his name. So it's that kind of painstaking research. There are incredible sources connected to the trial records, to newspaper accounts. They need to be used very, very carefully, and no one's really done that. So in a sense, it would be impossible to do that on film until someone did it in writing, and I'm in the middle of doing that study now.
Well, that'll be interesting. Okay, a minute left. Quickly, let's comment on something that is usually associated with this whole story, which is the William Styron's novel back in 1967, The Confessions of Nat Turner. You spend a lot of time in the book on this, but very briefly, what's the issue here with that particular book?
Styron won the Pulitzer Prize for a novel about Nat Turner, and in his literary imagination, he created a Nat Turner who lusted after a white woman as one of the hearts of what motivated Nat Turner. And black critics of the 60s looked at that, looked at many other things as well, and said this was a white fantasy. So this book, which won the Pulitzer Prize, which then established Nat Turner's image in American culture, black critics immediately, and many whites as well, said this is a racist vision of Nat Turner. And actually, both in the book and in the film, what we try to show is a kind of a clash of worldviews, that Styron has a particular angle, a way of looking at things, and the black critics had a particular angle as well. That is not just a historical debate which you can settle through looking at the facts of the case.
Well, I hadn't thought of it from the perspective you just brought up, but I think the real value of the video in a way is it picks up on the book by presenting many different images, and it doesn't try to define one clear line when it comes to Nat Turner. So I think this is the real contribution to anyone who's really interested in the complexities of history.
I think that that's right. Usually there's a great temptation in film to simplify the storyline, and that's a mistake. It's not what historians do in their writing typically. Many do, but many don't. They point out the difficulty of knowing the truth of the past.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you for joining us. I wish we had more time to talk about it, but it's a great book and documentary.
Thank you very much.
Our guest this week has been Kenneth Greenberg, editor of Nat Turner, A Slave Rebellion in History and Memory, published by Oxford University Press, and co-producer, co-writer, and historian for the new documentary Nat Turner, A Troublesome Property, available from California Newsreel.
Let me tell you how I found the Lord.
Give me little time to
pray. With hung down head and aching heart.
Give me little time to pray. Give me little time to pray.
The angels wait.